Blog Talk Radio.
This is Tahaka. I'm unable to come to the phone at the moment, but if you need, leave your name, telephone number, and a brief message, I'll get back to you as fast as I can. Please.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options. We did not get your message, either because you were not speaking or because of a bad connection. To disconnect, press 1. To record your message, press 2. Are you still there? To disconnect, press 1. To record your message, press 2. Still there? To disconnect, press 1. To record your message, press 2. Sorry you were having trouble. Please try again later. Goodbye.
Ladies and gentlemen,
why has the history of African peoples been erased? Well, we don't live in a fair world. Things aren't fair. You don't get equal opportunities. You get the opportunities that you create for yourself. And if someone gets in there first and they conquer you, they colonize you, they enslave you, they simply make your history disappear to make it look like they conquered, colonized, and enslaved nobodies. When people have a history, that makes you a somebody. So if you remove the history, you become a nobody. And so your history disappearing, nobody's lamenting the loss of that history. That's why conquerors, colonizers, and enslavers make the people whose history they've conquered, colonized, and enslaved disappear. There are psychological reasons why people would want to associate themselves with a history. There is a link between what someone thinks of themselves, what someone thinks of their people, and their history. Now, scholars talk about... Why has the history of African peoples been erased? Well, we don't live in a fair world. Things aren't fair. You don't get equal opportunities. You get the opportunities that you create for yourself. And if someone gets in there first and they conquer you, they colonize you, they enslave you, they simply make your history disappear to make it look like they conquered, colonized, and enslaved nobodies. When people have a history, that makes you a somebody. So if you remove the history, you become a nobody. And so your history disappearing, nobody's lamenting the loss of that history. That's why conquerors, colonizers, and enslavers make the people whose history they've conquered, colonized, and enslaved disappear. There are psychological reasons why people would want to associate themselves with a history. There is a link between what someone thinks of themselves, what someone thinks of their people, and their history. Now, scholars talk about personal esteem. That means self-esteem. And then you have interpersonal or group esteem, which is what you think of your group or what you think of your race, racial esteem. Self-esteem and racial esteem are not the same thing. Someone can have very high self-esteem where they think highly of themselves and very low racial esteem where they think very badly of other black people. And in truth, most black people have very high self-esteem and very low racial esteem. And that's one of the reasons why black people are prone to fight each other, prone to disagree with each other, prone to conflict with each other, because someone thinks very highly of themselves and someone thinks very lowly of their group. And what happens is, if people can call each other the N and the B words, they're really saying, I don't give a monkey's about the black race. They've really just said that their racial esteem is very, very low. But every black person usually has very high personal esteem. So if someone thinks highly of themselves and very lowly of their group, that is a recipe for fighting. That is a recipe for conflict. And the way to raise people's racial esteem is to introduce them to their history. And if the history happens to be a great history, a history that people objectively can be proud of, they will see their people in a very different way to how they see their people at present. And that's the difference between high self-esteem, low racial esteem, to having a balance where you have high self-esteem and high racial or ethnic esteem. The purpose of my work generally is to build that psychological balance between high personal esteem and high self-esteem.
everybody. It's me again, Tahaka. America is experiencing some tough times today, but there's a way out for you. All you have to do is get into the private, live out your days as a secured party and a creditor, instead of living as a debtor. I'll show you how. Visit TahakaDebtElimination.org. My contact information is there. It has to be tough struggling trying to make ends meet. But as a secure party and creditor, life's a little bit sweeter. All your bill collectors got you listed as a debtor. Let's turn this thing around. TahakaDebtElimination.org. Peace. Tahaka here, y'all. Where were the judges, lawyers, prosecutors, police, et cetera, when she got pregnant with your child? They weren't in the bedroom or in the place where you two were. But now they're up in your business about child support and how much you have to pay and when, where, and why you have to see them about your child. Let's deal with it. Go to www.TahakaDebtElimination.org. They did me like that one time because I didn't know who I was. But it's a different day now. My contact information is at TahakaDebtElimination.org. Let's deal with the child support thing, man. Peace. Remember to pay yourself first. The greatest focal point in your life is when preparedness and opportunity meet. Mortgages, foreclosures, property taxes can be a thing of the past. It's all up to you to be in honor. We have public and we have private. When it comes to mortgages and foreclosures, the banks don't have no skin in the game. And property taxes are outright illegal. But if you don't know no better, you just keep drinking the Kool-Aid. Cut it out, y'all. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Now is the time to get out of debt. The opportunity is here. This is your greatest focal point. Let's shut this thing down, man. Get out of debt now. Peace.
This video is brought to you by Captivating History. After a series of tragedies known as the Crisis of the Late Middle Ages, including events such as the Great Famine and Black Death, came a period of explosive social and cultural. This video is brought to you by Captivating History. After a series of tragedies known as the Crisis of the Late Middle Ages, including events such as the Great Famine and Black Death, came a period of explosive social and cultural development. This period left such a mark on the history of Europe that it still shapes much of our modern world today. Known as the Renaissance, this period takes its name from the French word for rebirth. Considering the cavalcade of disasters that befell Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire, nothing could describe the Renaissance better than a complete rebirth of Europe. Considering the darkness it sprung out of, you might be wondering just how this miraculous period came about or how long it lasted. We're here to answer those questions and a lot more you didn't even know you had about the Renaissance. This topic comprises hundreds of years of history. This video should be considered a crash course of some of the most need-to-know info about the Renaissance. We must consider Rome first. The Roman Empire was spread throughout Europe, Asia, and even parts of Africa, lasting from around 700 BC to around 1400 AD, over 2,000 years. As Rome spread far and wide, the emperors, like Caesar, exerted relentless control of the local tribes. Native cultures were weeded out constantly, replaced with what the Romans believed was a superior way of life. The Roman focus on infrastructure aided this. They paved roads, built bridges, and enabled free movement of people, goods, and even ideas. All things end, though, and once Rome fell, all of those things declined with the empire bit by bit. Food shortages began, famines hit much of Europe, and small kingdoms that occupied the Roman power vacuum watched each other with intense uneasiness. While the plague decimated populations, it also freed up capital for the aristocracy to invest in fine arts and scholarly pursuits. A lot of things were happening in Florence around this time. Even during the plague, great efforts were undertaken, such as creating the Gates of Paradise, a set of glorious bronze doors set into the Florence Baptistry, hoping they might encourage God to go easy on Florence in terms of the plague. Unfortunately, the Black Death continued to spread, and the people of Florence tried everything from strong perfume to pills made of rose hips to fight the disease. As this all went down, the Dark Ages seemed like they might never go away. While the Dark Ages can be said to have begun in Italy with the fall of Rome, we can thank the people of Florence for the beginning of the Renaissance. What's so special about Florence, though? About halfway between Rome and Milan, Florence was one of the most robust sites of trade and commerce in Europe. The old roads that had broken down with the fall of Rome were recovered near Milan, and new routes were established that solidified Florence's role as an international power player. Aiding this consolidation of influence was the reintroduction of a gold-based currency, the florin. With Rome's collapse, the most common international currencies had been missing for around 500 years, and this new currency brought trade from all over the world. The Florentines even created a new form of bookkeeping that helped them corner ancient stock markets. The wealth pouring into Florence created something new and exciting, the European middle class. These were people with disposable income, not burdened with constant labor or debts. Young people across Florence once again turned their sights to pursuing art and philosophy, even the natural sciences. Painting, sculpture, glasswork, poetry, architecture, and more forms of expression all found a new life in Florence around this time. The first collections of humanist philosophy were written, marking a distinct change in the attitude of people living in this age. The idea that you should show faith in people's ability to know right from wrong and make better choices through better education emerged. Thanks to Francesco Petrarca, a devout Catholic who sought to unify the ideas of humanism and Christianity. His works were so influential and widespread that he was honored as an official poet of Rome, complete with a laurel wreath. As men like Petrarch explored the subtler details of human experience, others appeared who wielded their own sets of artistic skills. People like Giotto di Bondone created works such as The Life of Christ, moving the popular styles of paintings away from the Byzantine era's sharp angularity toward natural forms and rhythms. Far away from Italy, the Dutch were experimenting with oil paints. Dutch artists like Jan van Eyck worked on mixing linseed oil with their pigments instead of fast-drying egg whites. Gorgeous renderings of realism and vibrant color began to be produced with this slow-drying medium. Works like The Adoration of the Lamb helped cement him as one of the most influential creators of the century. The end of the 15th century birthed the careers of some of the very most influential people of the 1400s, whose works you may be familiar with. Born in 1452, Leonardo da Vinci was provided the perfect set of circumstances to grow into a master artist, scientist, and excessively talented polymath. The Ottomans finally conquered Constantinople a year after his birth, sending Greeks and refugees of war westward into the greater European continent, bringing goods and ideas with them. A year after that, a critical development took place. The printing press was used to create the Gutenberg Bible, a mass-produced literary work that opened the door to expanding European literacy to unheard-of levels. The Medici family assumed power in Florence, with Lorenzo the Magnificent Medici bringing about the highest point of the Florentine Renaissance. Da Vinci studied in Florence under Andrea del Verrocchio and learned sculpture and how to work with precious metals during this golden age. A year after Lorenzo the Magnificent took office, Da Vinci began his professional career, which would give rise to some of the most famous artworks of all time. The Mona Lisa, The Last Supper, and The Vitruvian Man all hint at the incredible anatomical and medical illustrations Da Vinci eventually produced. Of the main innovations of the 15th century, exploration was one of the most important. Sailors made some of the most groundbreaking discoveries in the last quarter of the 1400s. Columbus reached the Bahamas in 1492, and Vasco da Gama doing what Columbus set out to do by reaching India in 1498. A year later, at the turn of the century, wars that had broken out near the end of the 1400s saw France conquering Milan and bringing a treasure trove of Italian art and ideas spilling into France. Though Rome had fallen before the Black Death, the turn of the 16th century saw Julius II ascended to the papacy, which heralded the beginning of the Roman Golden Age. Half a decade later, Henry VIII assumed power in England, which set the stage for the Reformation, a spiritual movement that forever divided the European continent. Earlier humanist thinking influenced the schism, as did the sacking of Rome, which prevented Henry VIII's divorce from Catherine of Aragon. In the mid-16th century, tensions caused by the Reformation were eased by the ascent of Elizabeth Tudor to the English throne. This brought about England's own Golden Age, which brought about education reforms that saw the enlightenment of the Renaissance. This video is brought to you.
Alexa, what time is it?
It's 6:31 p.m.
One of the most popular historical periods mentioned frequently in Western culture tends to be the Renaissance. The Renaissance was a time in which Europeans were, in a sense, evolving in their thinking, growing in their understanding of the world, and improving upon the ideas of classical antiquity. This was a pretty important time in European history. Since we've heard so much about this time period in world history, I thought it would be a good idea to discuss what was going on in Africa during this time. What up, African world? It's Home Team here, and welcome back to another video of African history, culture, and worldview. By supporting this channel on Patreon, you're helping in the creation of these videos and contributing to this content. On Patreon, you can find more in-depth courses on African history. And with a word from my sponsors, the Only Great Nation NFTs are a total collection of 5,000 digital images of five of the most popular kings of Africa, each carefully curated with 1,000 variations of the five kings. By creating these collectible goodies online of African history, there's no way that the African greats can be forgotten. With this exposure, Only the Great Nation hopes to popularize these legendary figures by spearheading a digital renaissance for the rediscovery of African history. Only the Great Nation provides a resource that all history enthusiasts can engage and ultimately promote. To learn more, visit onlythegreatnation.com. Links to Patreon and Only the Great Nation in the description box below. The Renaissance, generally speaking, is believed to have taken place from the 14th to the 17th century. Scholars may give different dates, but for the sake of this video, we'll stick with this time frame. It's important to note that many things were happening in Africa during this time, and I can't mention all of them, so please feel free to mention some events you may be aware of that occurred during this period. To be honest, this video was a bit overwhelming, as this time frame can be considered Africa's prime, if you will. I will try my best to include as much as possible, but again, I will be missing a lot. So let's begin. Interestingly enough, in relation to...
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's see. Eric Cole, 312. Brother UL, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I hear you now loud and clear, but this time I didn't have the problem hearing you.
Okay.
So, yes, I'm here. This is Brother UL calling from Chicago, of course. From Underground Bookstore, where you can find any of the books that you're looking for, or if you don't have it, we can get it.
Okay. Fantastic. Now, let me mute Dr. Williams' mic and see if I can bring him back in. His call dropped twice on me. Air code 773, Dr. Walter Williams, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here, Brother Tarf. I've been here since... 10 minutes after.
I know, man. I had something's going on, some kind of technical difficulties or something here, man. But we in here. We done lost a lot of time, but we're here now. Brother UL, he's on. And so let's ready to roll. The type of the broadcast, title of the broadcast is The African Who Set the Stage for the European Renaissance. And you have the floor, Brother UL. I'm going to mute your mic and let Dr. Williams go. Okay, Dr. Weave, we're listening to you.
Okay, well, the first Renaissance of Europe happened in Spain, in 1091, when the Spanish-speaking people asked ASK, the ancient Egyptians who lived in those countries along North Africa, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and Mauritania, which Mauritania borders the Atlantic Ocean. So they asked them to come in, the ancient Egyptians, to come in and bring civilization to uncivilized Spain. So in 1091, they embarked on doing just that, the ancient Egyptians did. They arrived in Spain in 1091 by way of Morocco. And when they got to Spain, the first thing they learned was the Spanish language. And after learning the Spanish language, they created an alphabet for that language. The same way they did when the Greeks came into Egypt in 332 BCE under the leadership of Alexander the Great. Alexander and his men were received by the Melkite Coptic Egyptians who ran the government of ancient Egypt. And seeing that the Greeks were not going to leave, the Melkite Coptic Egyptians learned the Greek language in order to communicate with the Greeks by way of a language. After learning that language, they applied an alphabet to the Greek language. So the Greeks never had an alphabet. They were illiterate, uncivilized, spiritually dead savages. And after learning that language, they applied an alphabet to it. So today you have a Greek alphabet. And from that alphabet, a lot of things happen. So let's go back to now, back to Spain. After coming to Spain, after being asked by the Spanish-speaking people to bring civilization to uncivilized Spain, they learned the Spanish language in order to communicate with them. And they applied an alphabet to that Spanish language. The hieratic, mnemonic alphabet, which consists of letters. And those letters today are misnomered and called the English alphabet. English or Europeans never had an alphabet. Okay? So it's the correct name for what we call the English alphabet is the phonetic, hieratic, demotic alphabet created by our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians. So after learning that alphabet, the first thing in Spain they did was put an alphabet to the Spanish language. So that was the first Renaissance era that happened in for the Europeans, happened and started in Spain. They began to set up governments over there in Spain for the uncivilized Spanish people. They began to build cities throughout Spain, Toledo, Granada, Seville, Cadillac, et cetera, et cetera. And they introduced bath houses over there and introduced soap to the uncivilized Spanish people. So that's how the first Renaissance of Europe began, right there in Spain. The second Renaissance era started in Europe, okay, by a man called Manuel Chrysoloras, who taught and lived in Constantinople, Turkey. Now, mind you, I'm going to take you to the first church ever existed on planet Earth, and that being the Church of Hagia Sophia. In the Church of Hagia Sophia. That church was turned into a school. They had a school in there. The first school for to teach classes in that school. And they taught the hand-picked Greek men who were allowed to come in there by way of choice. And it opened it up to everybody. Just a handful of Greeks came and to learn at the Church of Hagia Sophia. The teaching staff in the Church of Hagia Sophia was consistent and comprised of African teachers and African scholars. And they taught the Greeks how to read and write, spell, and they taught them different subjects such as the sciences, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we come up to the Renaissance era. Like I said before, the teaching staff at the Hagia Sophia, the first university for the Europe, were all African. Now we're going to come up to the Renaissance era of the 15th and 16th century in Europe. And a man by the name of Manuel Chrysoloras, Manuel Chrysoloras, Manuel Chrysoloras, he set out for Constantinople. He was born in Constantinople, and he was a member of the teaching staff at the first university that I mentioned for the Europeans, and he and opened up at the beginning of the Renaissance era of the 15th and 16th century for the Europeans. That was in 1397. He went to Europe, and Europe was dark at that time because dark means that they were ignorant. They were uncivilized, and they didn't have any writing system. They were illiterate. So what he did in 1397, he went to Europe, dark. Darkness in Europe. So what he did, he hit the light switch, because when you come into a dark room and you want to illuminate that room, the first thing you do is hit a switch, a light switch, and that room is illuminated. So this is what Manuel Chrysoloras did. So I want to introduce Manuel Chrysoloras to our listening audience. Let them know who started the Renaissance era for the Europeans. It wasn't a European, it was an African by the name of Manuel Chrysoloras, born in Constantinople, Turkey. And he and his group of other African scholars went into Italy. Italy is the country where the second Renaissance era of Europe started. They went to Florence, Italy, a curia there, a college that they started there in Florence, Italy, and also in Ferrara, Italy. Those two places where they began to teach. Manuel Chrysoloras and his other African scholars, they split the two places in Florence and Ferrara, Italy, to teach the Europeans to bring about the first Renaissance in Europe. Manuel Chrysoloras introduced to his students, along with his teaching staff of Upper Africa. They introduced what is known as Platoism. Platoism is a philosophy. Okay? It has a lot of components in Platoism. You have metaphysics in there. You have the alphabet in there. You have philosophy in there, and Platoism. Now, Plato never existed as a human being. But we're talking about Platoism, which is a form of teaching, a form of philosophy, like I mentioned. It is to get the students to think and analyze their minds on things that are out in the world today. So this is what happened in Europe. This is the reason why I'm going to bring to our African community about Manuel Chrysostom, the African. Today, if you pull up Manuel Chrysostom, they'll show you a picture of a white man. Of course, they don't want you to know and the world to know that these Europeans were taught by. So that's what I want to do, Brother Tahaka.
Okay, Dr. Williams, that's fantastic, man. I'm going to open up Brother Yoel's line in a minute. And I have some questions for you. But before I get into these questions, I want to make a little quick announcement to the listening audience. For those of you who listen to our broadcast, they are converted into YouTube videos. And when you get over there to YouTube, look in the right corner of the screen, you see a little red button. Go ahead and push that button and subscribe to my channel. So if you are not able to get on a live broadcast, you can always go back and click on any video that I got over there to take you to my subscription page, and you can do your catch-up from there. I'm going to open up Brother UL's line in just a moment. But Dr. Williams, let me ask you something. Now, what has the Renaissance become today? What did it did it morph into today? What's your opinion on that?
About the European Renaissance? Well, what's that again?
Go ahead, I'm listening.
The European Renaissance open up a literacy for the uncivilized Europeans. You see? The only people that had literacy was our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians. And they're the ones who taught the Spanish people literacy. They taught the Europeans literacy during the Renaissance era of the 15th and 16th century. So that's what that was all about, Brother Tahaka.
Okay. So the brother that started this thing, what was his reason for doing so again?
Well, he was asked to come to Europe to bring the Europeans out of the Dark Ages into the light. So in 1397, he went over there, being invited. He went there and turned the light switch on for them, for the Europeans to come out of the darkness into the light. And then he and his staff of African scholars and teachers began teaching that the Curia, C-U-R-I-A, means college at Florence, Italy, and Ferrara, Italy. And that broke and started the Renaissance era and broke your ignorance of the Europeans. They only had a hand few now. They wouldn't let everybody come in there, and especially no women. Okay? Women was out, that was off key to them. No, they didn't want no women. They only want hand few picked Europeans to do that. And they didn't pass the Europeans after learning from these African scholars, then they kept what they was taught in a, let's say, in a package, and they kept it to themselves. They didn't spread it. Brother Tucker.
Okay. All right. Now, I'm going to open up Brother UL's line so he can give us his take on this thing. Brother UL, are you still with us? Still with me, Brother UL?
Yes, sir. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're coming across loud and clear. Now, what's your take on the Renaissance? Because you got a bookstore over there, and I know you got a lot of information involving the Renaissance. Have you studied that?
Well, I'm afraid to disappoint you, Tahaka, but no, I don't have a lot of information on the Renaissance. Because that's not what's been in demand by your people.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, could you give us how to get a hold of you and get a hold of these books and hard to find books and stuff in your location?
Okay. Yes, I will. But let me just say that when I give that, I want Professor Williams to first of all deal with. This is a statement in the form of a question. Define what a Renaissance is, first of all. Second, because most people that only taught that probably in America. I don't know if they teach that in any other country or not, because I've never been to anyone who's taught that, but that would be a good place to start with our conversation. But they can get in touch with me at the Underground Bookstore in Chicago, of course, located at 1727 East 87th Street. If you're in town visiting or anything, or got relatives going to be in town, they can stop by at 1727 East 87th Street, or they can call me at 773-768-8869, or they can email me at undergroundbookstore1@gmail.com. That's undergroundbookstore1@gmail.com. So those are the ways they contact me for any books that they might be looking for. And I like to say to that listening audience, for those who are listening, let's put some action behind what I just said and call me up. And let's see who's listening, and let's see what books that you want to purchase. Because we have to change the narrative of you getting on the computer and ordering from Mr. Amazon, because you ain't going to get this from Mr. Amazon. He ain't trying to do nothing with you but get your money. Okay? So,
okay.
Hopefully for those who are listening, there's at least one book that you might be looking for or that you will want to get that you might want to order. Give Brother Yoel a chance. How about that? So, with that said, I'll turn it back over to you, Doctor.
Okay, Brother Yoel. Thank you, man. I'm going to mute your mic for a minute. And because I have another question for Dr. Williams. Dr. Williams, this is my question for you. Can you give us a detailed description on what the Dark Ages was like for Europeans?
The Dark Ages for the Europeans consists of ignorance, illiteracy, backwardness, not knowing, not literate because they had no alphabet to write with. So it was the Dark Ages. So Manuel Chrysostomus, the African, and his teaching staff of other Africans that came out of Constantinople, that came from that world's first Christian church, the Hagia Sophia, they went over there and changed all that for them. See? Now, I heard some of your videos that you've been playing this evening, and they, boy, they really got a lot of misinformation in those, and that, and those videos that and audios that you're playing this evening. But anyway, that's what the main thing that the that the Renaissance era did for the Europeans. He was illiterate. He had no alphabet. Never had an alphabet. He was the main thing I'm bringing to our listening African listening audience is and introducing Manuel Chrysostomus, the African, and what he did, see, for the Europeans. You see, so that's my answer to you.
Okay, now. And one more time, where did this operation that the African gun is involved in the Renaissance, exactly where did it begin again?
It began in Italy, in two places, Florence, Italy, the Curia there, the college there, and the Curia in Ferrara, Italy. Those are the two places where the beginning of the Renaissance era started. And that's where Manuel Chrysostomus began his teaching. Other African scholars from Northeast Africa, known today as the Middle East, coming out of the Hagia Sophia. That's where they started in Europe. At those two spots.
Okay. Now, prior to that, we had it. Now, how close was that time period when that began? How close was that to the bubonic plague or the Black Death of Europe?
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. There's people who are narrating that piece of audio that you played is taking you away from things. Okay? I'm not interested in the Black Plague of Europe. That's not the subject. The subject tonight is I'm introducing to our African community, our audience on the Tahaka Omani Obey show about the Africans who went and started the Renaissance era for the Europeans. That's what we have to focus on.
I understand that, Dr. Wayne, but the only thing I'm doing is just asking you a question. I'm trying to get some timing of sequence of events. Did the Renaissance situation happen before that incident, or was it after that incident? I understand everything you're saying. It's just a question.
Okay, before.
Thank you. That's all I needed to know. Okay, now, what I want to know now is how important is it for, and what can we do with the information that you just gave us about the brother actually starting the Renaissance for the European? What can we do with that today?
What you can do with that is, in first place, is to enhance your knowledge. That will give you more knowledge of who our ancestors are and the history of what they were involved in. So that will give you an expansion of that. In other words, instead of revolving in something that you already know, this will give you information to start you to evolve, expand your knowledge. See, they tell us and teach the world that they taught us, the Europeans. You tell the world that they taught us, Africans, that we had nothing to teach the world. We had nothing that was great pertaining to the world. They teach us away from ancient Egypt, away from our ancestors building the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. The body of the Sphinx is 2 city blocks long, okay? 6 stories high with an African face carved in stone. The Great Pyramid, they use a mathematical formula that nobody has ever figured out the mathematical formula that the ancient Egyptians used to build the Great Pyramid, which was originally built 490 feet high in the air. Okay? And they didn't have any modern cranes and things like that to bring those stones up to that height. So that's the reason why we have to bring any information that is facts now. We don't want to bring misinformation to our community. We want to bring facts to our African community so they can begin to feel proud of themselves and know the truth and begin to evolve in that knowledge. So that's the purpose of the talk.
All right. Now, I know there was a time period when Europeans were taking paintings and falsifying these paintings and erasing the actual individual and putting themselves as the individual who actually done the event. Would you consider that to be part of the Renaissance too?
What year are you talking about? It's very important.
I'm talking about after the Renaissance and all the way up till today. They're all over in Egypt whitewashing stuff and inserting themselves into Egypt.
Well, that was done by what is known as the Spanish and Roman Catholic Church Inquisition of 1478, which Ferdinand and Isabella called that that 1478 and the Roman Catholic Church not Renaissance but the 1478 to get rid of the Moors and the Africans out of Spain, erase their history from ever being over there. Okay? It's called the Inquisition period. You see, that goes into another history. But that's what happened. They wanted to erase the presence of the Africans ever being in Spain and in the Vatican. Okay? They didn't want the world to know that it was our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, who were called to Italy in 1439 by John the Eighth, when he called and moved the seat of Christianity, which is the Hagia Sophia, out of Africa, because it was imminent that the Ottoman Turks was going to break through that wall, the double wall city of Constantinople. Constantinople today is called Istanbul, Turkey, and break through that double wall city and seize the city and the church. So he, in 1439, He moved it out of Africa and into Italy, releasing what is known in history as the Donation of Constantine. So when that was done, the Europeans who received the responsibility to build the second seat or the second church for Christianity, which was six humanists from the Curia, the college at Ferrara, Italy, and six from the college in Florence, Italy. So you had 12 men. So they went to the authorities in Rome to ask for them, for the Roman authorities, to give them an allotment of land to build this church. Okay? And they gave them allotment of land on the outskirts of Rome near the catacombs, which is, that church is still there today. The church is called St. Peter's Church, known today as St. Peter's Basilica. That is still there today. You see? So, from that, then things begin to change in a different direction for the Europeans during the Renaissance era. You see? And you got, when they built that church called St. Peter's Church, known today as St. Peter's Basilica, in 1397, they built the Sistine Chapel, where the Pope lives today. And they changed everything around because the change came about when the birth of Leonardo da Vinci was in 1452. And after his birth, he was an artist. He knew how to draw paintings and so forth and so on. So the Roman Catholic Church at that time asked Leonardo da Vinci to draw something on Christ, and he drew the Last Supper. The Last Supper is not something in human reality, but it's a painting created by Leonardo da Vinci for the Roman Catholic Church. And it shows this Christ sitting with 12 of his disciples to have his Last Supper before they crucify him. That's just a painting. The next painting that was created by Leonardo da Vinci was the crucifix, a picture of this Christ carrying his cross on Calvary to be crucified. Okay? And then the next painting was a painting by Leonardo da Vinci of Mary Magdalene when she approached the tomb of Christ. And she noticed upon approaching that tomb, it was a stone rolled back, and she looked down in the grave where he was supposed to be buried, and it was empty. So he had ascended on to heaven to be with his Father. Okay? Those are all paintings. It has nothing to do with human history or reality. The words that was put to each painting was done by Desiderius Erasmus, the man who was a playwright and the one that created the Novum Testamentum or the New Testament. So it goes on from there, Brother Tarka. So that will be my answer to you.
Okay, well, Dr. Williams, I'm going to take a little quick break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask you some more questions. So if you would, just hold on a minute. I'm going to mute your mic, and we'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, now is the time for you to become a secured party and a creditor and get out of the public and into the private. I can't stress that enough because we're having some turbulent times here, and you need a shield. And so if you go over there to talkingdebtelimination.org, and you see a little link over there that says subscribe, you'll be subscribing to my channel over there on YouTube. And, of course, you can listen to our previous broadcast, and I have a video there explaining this stuff about the law, okay? We're going to take a little quick break. When we come back, the phone lines will be open. The number to dial into the broadcast is 515-605-9757. Press 1 on your phone. That'll give me an indication that you got something to say, and open up the phone lines so you can get in. So hold your hat for a minute. We will be right back. Hold on.
You ain't in my way. Do what nobody has to say.
Yeah.
way or no way at all. I'll do it my way, my way, my way.
Yeah.
My way, my way or no way at all.
Comment, the phone lines are wide open. Our special guest is Dr. Walter Williams. Tonight's broadcast is on the African who set the stage for the European Renaissance. I'm going to open up Dr. Williams' phone line again and continue my questions because I got some more questions, okay? And but before we do, I'm going to open up Brother UL's phone line to see if you want to weigh in on what's been said so far. So everybody just hold on a minute. Brother UL, can you... give us some more information on what Dr. Williams was saying before I open up his line.
Well, no, it's his show, Doc. So the
okay.
Only thing I well, maybe my comment on, and that is supposedly Hannibal, the whole Hannibal thing, supposedly took place before that. Is that correct?
All right, let's see. Dr. Williams, did you hear Brother
Yoel's
question?
There's never been a Hannibal.
Okay.
Mythology. Okay. Never been a Hannibal.
Okay.
Not no African Hannibal. You got Hannibal Bacar, who lived in a small town in Spain, off the Mediterranean. And if you believe the story that's attached to Hannibal Bacar, that he had 132 infantry men and 90,000 cavalry men and one elephant that they walked all through Spain, all through France, which France is a border of Spain, walked all up into the Alps and down into Italy. You believe that story? Because remember now, elephants, oh yeah, 40 elephants, I'm sorry. Elephants don't eat snow. Elephants are a warm-blooded mammal. So all those things, if you use your analytical mind, you see it's nothing but mythology. So don't go for the Hannibal story. And they're going to try to make Hannibal an African general, the greatest ever happened, ever existed. Please, give me a break. Don't go for the Hannibal story.
Okay, Brother UL, we can, I guess we can flush that one on down.
Okay.
All right.
So,
with
this, with inviting them into Italy, then with the start of that, is that where these the miscegenation took place with the Sicilians and all that? Then
forget about that. I tell you, the Hannibal story is misleading. No Hannibal.
No,
ever.
I didn't say anything about Hannibal.
What'd you say?
I said, okay, I'm asking that is at the time you're talking about, when they invited, well, when they went to Italy in this Renaissance, is that when the Africans, were they there before that, or were they came there during that time and that invitation, and that's where the Sicilians supposedly came from?
No, no. Sicilians mean... That word Sicilian only means in Italian. From Sicily.
Okay.
Okay, that's what it means. An Italian from Sicily, Sicilian. Okay. I'm saying to you, see, everything I give by way of history, I give you the foundation of it first. See, without the foundation, you have nothing, anything on top of without a foundation. Without a foundation, you cannot build a building or a house. You've got to have a foundation.
Right. Right.
So I bring to our African listening audience on this program and other programs that I'm on the foundation of the subject. See? And then you can go from there. So that would be my answer to you. Sicilian, like I said, is an Italian that's from Sicily.
Okay, Dr. Williams, I think you answered that one. Could you give us an update on your new book that you're coming out with? What's the latest?
Well, the latest will be this summer. Well, we're right at the summer. So, it's a matter of let's say 4 months from now. And my new book is called Dispelling Myths of Ancient Egypt. And on the cover, the front cover of that book, you have a picture of the Sphinx in front of the pyramid. And also on the front cover, I have a winged Maat. With her wings spread, and she got with her headband and feather, symbolizing that she is Maat. It's a beautiful covered book, and there's a lot of information in that book. I have a chapter in that book entitled Civilization: The African Ancient Egyptian Gift to the World. And in that chapter, I list everything that came out of the culture of our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, what they invented. Literacy. The alphabet is makes, if you learn the alphabet, the first thing you learn in school, that makes you literate. If you learn A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and so forth and so on. From the alphabet came the musical scale. Do, re, mi, so, fa, la, ti, do. See? So from that alphabet, the world's first alphabet created by our ancestors, ancient Egyptians, came music. They were the first musicians on planet Earth. They were female, the first musicians on Earth. And then I bring forth and show all forms of mathematics that was created there. So that's what my book is all about. Now, that's chapter 6. Now listen to chapter 7. Death and destruction is the gift that the European, and I got in parentheses, white people gave to the world. Death and destruction. This is what they brought to the world of humanity. And I'm saying that I gave some definition as to what they brought to the world of humanity, which is death and destruction, by way of lies, deceit, murder, injustice, corruption, greed, terrorism, militarism, sexism, racism, slavery, exploitation, evilness, misery, genocide, hypocrisy, stealing, cheating, suffering, drugs, disease, death and destruction, war, guns, bullets, plunder, rape, hate, torture, white supremacy, white superiority, religion, mythology, and perverted scholarship. That's what the Europeans have brought to this world, the day of humanity. And then also in that chapter, I bring out what the European has done to us as a people by way of bombing those four innocent children in Alabama, at the church in Alabama. Okay, I think it was in 1960. I forget the date, but anyway, that church bombing that took place of those four innocent young innocent children in that church that was bombed by the Ku Klux Klan. I bring out in that book about Emmett Till's murder that happened in 1955. And the FBI knew who bombed that church and who killed Emmett Till, and they made no arrest because we have no rights that a white man has to respect. So I'm bringing all of that out, and I'm bringing out what is going on over in Palestine with the Israelis and the Palestinians. When in 1966, President Jimmy Carter went over there in Palestine to see firsthand what was happening over there in Palestine with the Israelis and the Palestinians. And he came back, and he wrote a book in 1966, I believe, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. So that is some of my books, that is some of the things in my books that I'm writing about. And also in my book I have a picture gallery showing people like us that is the now survivors and the descendants of ancient Egyptians, how we look today compared to how our ancestors looked during the time of antiquity in Egypt. So it's going to be a very learned book where we'll teach our people that they don't have to be on the bottom and be ashamed of what the white folks put us there to give us shame and dehumanize us before the world populace of people. So I'm bringing us back to our rightful place in world history and world order. So this book, I'm very excited about it. So it's we're working on it every week and every day. So just listen, audience, be patient, and I'll get you this book. This book is going to be in all African colleges and universities throughout America where they have Black Studies Department. It's going to go into all those places. And we'll show you how they try to, I got another last chapter I'm writing now at this very moment. It's called America the Hypocrite. I'm showing you how the United States of America is a hypocrite and what they have done to us to make me make that statement. So I'm very excited about it myself. That's what the book is all about, Brother Todd.
Okay, well, fantastic, Dr. Williams. I can't wait for its completion so that I can get a copy of that. I definitely want to get up in there. Let me ask you another question. Now, I know in his book, Stanley Lane Poole, The Moors in Spain, the Moors had introduced bathing and stuff, but when they drove the Moors out of Spain, Ferdinand and Isabella outlawed bathing. So it seems to me that creating some type of civilization with these particular people just outright didn't work. I mean, for you to do something like that. And so I'm still trying to get the time right on that, because they drove the Moors out of Spain in 1492. And so I'm trying to figure out, was that consistent with leading to the bubonic plague?
No, see, once you introduce bathing and soap to a people, you can't outlaw that. They're going to take a bath anyway. You got a bunch of stuff.
The way I'm looking at it is, when it came into Spain, undoubtedly, that was not a common practice, because the Moors had to introduce it and build public baths so a man could just walk off the sidewalk, go behind a wall and take a bath. But when the Moors were driven out of Spain, they made it against the law. So in other words, it seemed to me that they were trying to go back to what they were doing in the first place. That's what I figured after reading the passage and studying it.
Okay, well, you got to figure out where that came from number one. And to me, that don't make sense. If I teach you how to clean yourself with soap and take a bath, you cannot outlaw that. Because you can't police the whole country and all the people living therein. So you got to also find out where that came, analyzation came from. Who put that out there? See, very important. What year did they put it out? Who are they? Are they, you know, why did they put it out? Things like that. You got, me personally, I don't believe it.
Okay, well, that's what was written in the Moors, in Spain, by Stanley Lane Poole. He also mentions that there was a woman that was boasting and bragging about she had never taken a bath, and the only thing that she would do is dip her fingers in the water when it came to the mass. Now, that is also written in that book.
Well,
Arthur Blank.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to study Stanley Lane Poole. See that? I mean, where is he getting this from? What's his reference? You know, what year was this book written? You got to investigate where the information is coming from. That's all I have to say about that.
Okay. All right. Well, it was just a question that I thought I would ask you, Dr. Williams. And I didn't know whether or not you have never stated that you were familiar with The Moors in Spain by Stanley Lane Poole.
Well, I know of Stanley Lane Poole. You know, a lot of stuff I don't agree with Stanley Lane Poole.
Okay.
You know, a lot of
stuff I don't. Okay, let me add him over there to this list on the side. Okay, so we got him over there. Brother Yoel.
Yes, sir.
What is your knowledge? And I'm going to ask Dr. Williams the same question. But could you fill us in a little bit more on the Spanish Inquisition from your perspective?
Well, I can only add to a little something to what you was asking, Professor Williams, about the bathing and all and outlawing it. I don't know about the outlawing, but I do know there's a book that I carry called Dirt, and that book speaks to Europeans and how they did not take baths, and they will wear their clothing, and sometimes they would wear these big coats that would develop fleas or things like that on these clothing, and if they wore underwear at all, they wore these things till they fell off. And all that kind of stuff. This book about Terrence McLaughlin. That book went out of print some years ago, and it's just come back in print in the last couple of years. So that I can comment on.
Okay, well, I looked at a lot of videos about this type of condition as well. And the videos that I looked at pretty much say the same exact thing about that particular condition over Europe in the fleas and the rats and as Stanley Lane put it, they had chicken and cows and stuff in their houses. A lot of times they were living in barns with these animals. And this was just a part of their life. And so this is well knowledge. I got several, looked at several videos by several different authors that tell the exact same story about their condition.
They show you that sometime on some of their movies that they film during the time. Timeline. They show you some of that when you see them inside of their houses. And they even show some of it over here in America when they came here. Some of them was allowing the chickens and things like this to come up in the house and stuff like that. So, yeah, it happened.
Okay. All right. Well, before I bring Dr. Wynn back in, I'm going to take another little quick break. Because I have another plug we want to run, and then when we come back, we'll open it up. Keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, press 1 on your phone. That'll give me an indication that you got something to say. Okay? All right. Y'all hold on. We'll be right back.
Hello, everyone. My name is Florence Blackwell, and today I will be presenting my in-progress research from my Bachelor of Arts thesis entitled Whitewash, the Unwritten History of Black Africans in Renaissance Europe. The topics addressed in this presentation were inspired by my study abroad experience in Italy in 2019. As a student of art history, I was excited to finally have direct experiences with the artworks I had only ever seen in PowerPoint lectures and textbooks. What I was not expecting was to see people who look like me, Black people, because my education to that point suggested that Black people were not present in Europe during this epoch. However, considering the transatlantic slave trade began during the Renaissance, it would seem obvious that the human and financial capital that helped fund the art of this era would have a place in this history. Yet, to my surprise, in world-renowned churches and museums whose collections featured Black people, such as these two paintings, I did not observe any of their so-called experts discuss these subjects or their importance. Upon reflecting on my experiences in Italian museums and reviewing the art history curriculum at CU Denver, it became evident that art history is a predominantly white discipline. There is nothing unordinary about a course or textbook that focuses on European art to discuss and feature artworks created by white Europeans. However, it is problematic when the obvious presence of Black and Brown subjects in their work is avoided in the scholarship. For my Bachelor of Arts thesis, I'm investigating both how white subjectivity came to be the norm and analyzing recent scholarship that confronts the field's racism by attempting to see and center Black subjects in perspective. For this presentation, I will examine several well-known textbooks with a particular focus on Marilyn Stockstad's art history, whose enduring renown has secured it as the foundational text for CU Denver's art history survey courses. I will also review how the Renaissance came to be known as the period that gave birth to modern Western civilization through the lens of the United States. University of Kansas Professor Emerita Marilyn Stockstad wrote the first edition of her survey textbook, Art History, in 1995, and the sixth edition was published posthumously in 2018 by its co-author, Michael Cothran. Stockstad's textbook was my first introduction to art history. However, by judging the information it chooses to include, it implies it was written for white audiences and epitomizes the white supremacist pedagogy that has been rampant in art history since the discipline's beginning. This latest edition totals 1,017 pages, not including the contents and index. And in the preface, Cothran states that, quote, the sixth edition has been revised to reflect such new discoveries, recent research, and fresh interpretive perspectives, and also to address the changing need of the audience, both students and educators, unquote. In the table of contents, readers can visualize that the book's chapters are chronologically ordered from prehistory to contemporary art since the 1950s. At first glance, nothing about this list seems unordinary, but upon calculating the pagination, the data reveals that Europe and the United States comprises 55% of the textbook's contents, which speaks to Stockstad's and Cothran's Eurocentrism. These numbers are alarming and reveal a larger issue of BIPOC audiences in the 21st century being denied the experience of seeing themselves reflected in history, which is a privilege taken for granted by white audiences. Virtually no scholars have critiqued Marilyn Stockstad's art history at length, despite the text, the publication being a part of the long lineage of survey art history textbooks in the world. But long before there was Stockstad's text, there was the late art historian Helen Gardner in her pioneering textbook, Art Through the Ages, which remains a major contender in the publishing world. Gardner was an art history professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and in 1919, the Art Institute's affiliated Ryerson Library appointed her head of its photo and slide department. In the fall of 1920, she also established a lecture course called Survey of Art, whose influence still affects every art history curriculum in the United States. According to scholars Amina Cater, until Gardner published Art Through the Ages in 1926, quote, there had been no comparable single-volume art history text of such breadth and clarity written in English, unquote. Gardner's access to a major museum's photographs and slides collections allowed her to actualize her book project, and the first two editions of her book sold 260,000 copies, testifying to its popularity. Gardner was well-traveled and trained in the classics, and although her text is inherently Eurocentric, she deserves kudos because she did make a point to acknowledge non-European cultures in this pioneering text, which was more than what any of her contemporaries, like H.W. Jansen, were doing in their books. Later editions of Gardner's art history broadened its view to include more non-Western art. However, being that Stockstad's textbook is one of the youngest in the field, she had the opportunity to compare her writing to the massive other art history textbooks that came before, to establish hers as the first truly global art history textbook that was inclusive of non-Western perspectives, the so-called domestic arts, and women, even if it is still not nearly enough. Textbooks certify what is significant, but also have the potential to refute that significance over time through subsequent editions. As noted in a 2020 empirical study of Gardner's Art Through the Ages, quote, a canonical textbook exerts influences over art history as practice embedded. What is selected editorially, included as a representative of genres, what is excluded, and what is considered excellence can be found in textbooks as essential components in art historical knowledge, unquote. This study asserts that a textbook's power should not be minimized, for it is the gateway of knowledge that frames how a discipline is taught and applied by different generations of scholars. This point segues into the concept of the canon, which is a structural element of art history.
Okay, everybody, we're back. It appears that we have another caller with his hands raised. I'm going to open up the line. Area code 704. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question or comment for our guest?
Hello, come on in, man. Hello, Mr. Harker.
Yes, it is. What's going on?
So I'm calling. I hear Dr. Williams on your telecast talking about manual trisolos.
Okay.
He's still there.
Yeah, he's still on the broadcast. I just got his mic muted. But what's your take on the story?
Oh, the subject about what he was talking about, manual trisolos open up the Renaissance for the people at the college in Florence, Italy. I've studied his books, and his books have really opened up a whole lot of things for me about that period of time, about the Renaissance and all about the church in the East when the Arabs came, took it over. So they was going to move the seat to Italy. Then they was getting ready for it because it was imminent that the Ottoman Empire was going to take over Hagia Sophia. And I was reading that in the books, and I can see how everything was involving in everything because he talked about the Renaissance. And Spain was the first Renaissance when the Moors introduced those 14 universities over there, and that was the first Renaissance.
Okay, hold on. Let me get his line open.
Okay.
I didn't say anything about introducing those 14 universities.
I know, but I read something on it that they had those 14 universities over there in that the Moors was part of that learning that helped Spain during that time. They had up to 14 universities in Europe.
Okay, what's your question?
Okay, my question was that you was talking about, okay, I was reading your book where on page 45 of the Historical Origins of Islam, where you was talking about the incarnated names of Eusebius when you was saying that there was not no church then because you said that the Europeans do incarnated names and stuff. And so it's a lot of stuff that is very confusing because whenever you say about incarnated names, it brings, you know, a lot of stuff we try to study. It keeps us in the blind because they have did that through the mythology, what you was talking about. And it's very confusing on Wikipedia when you read some of these articles and stuff. And I think that you have really cleared up a whole lot of that stuff because when that perverted scholarship, when you use all them things what Europeans do to separate us and to keep us not, you know, remembering the ancient Egyptians, that they took everything about Egypt away from us through slavery, and that we don't really understand how great that our people was. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I talked to you before, which I talked to you at length, So I don't need to go over the same things I've talked to you before. So spare me that, because, you know, that's not the subject right now. But anyway,
okay.
I've talked to you before. You are kind of confused and mixed up, and I told you that. And so anyway, I'll leave it at that, and thank you for your call.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, my brother. Thank you for calling in. Okay. Now, Dr. Williams, now, when it comes to the, because you mentioned the Spanish Inquisition, can you give us some more details on that?
Yes. Before I get to that, Brother Tucker, I'm going to bring this introducing soap to uncivilized Spain.
Uh-huh.
The reason why soap was introduced, the people were funky.
Okay, but they thought it was normal.
Well, that's right. But see, our ancestors, you can't be around no funky person, a smelly person. You say, well, hey, man, go and take a bath somewhere. So they invented the bathhouses and introduced soap to them. See? So don't let nobody tell you anything different. You said
well,
that's
exactly what I was trying to point out in Stanley Lane Poole's book about the Moors in Spain.
Yeah, but they talk about how funky the people were. Well, that's the reason why the soap was introduced and public bathhouse was introduced by our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, to Spain, to the Spanish people. I just want to say that. And then what was your question, Brother Tucker?
About the Spanish Inquisition. Could you give us a little bit more details on that?
Well, the Spanish Inquisition started in Spanish and Roman Inquisition. That's how you have to say it. Meaning
okay.
The Spanish and Roman Catholic Church Inquisition. Because the Roman Catholic Church unified and joined with Spain. Spain was to be the army for the protection of the Roman Catholic Church. So in 1478, Ferdinand and Isabella called the Spanish Inquisition to come about, Spanish and Roman Catholic Church Inquisition to come about in 1478. That's how all that started. And because when you go today into these Latin countries, the people are speaking Spanish because it was forced on them by the Spanish government. And then also in all these Latin countries where they're speaking Spanish, you've got the Roman Catholic Church sitting right in the middle of them. So they're allied with each other to do just that. So that would be my answer, Brother Tucker.
Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is take another little quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue. But I still have some more questions that I need to ask you, Dr. Williams. So I'm going to just take a little quick break because I got to look at something for a minute. So y'all hold on a minute. We'll be right back.
everybody. We're back. Let me open up Dr. Williams' line. Dr. Williams, let me ask you a question. When you you attended college, did you not?
No, I didn't attend any college. I never been to college except for I took a couple of classes in college.
Okay.
So the people started teaching. The people started calling me Dr. Williams or Professor Williams. And then I created an ancient Egyptian museum and institute in Chicago here. And I wrote two books. So if an individual whoever creates their institution and write a couple of books as his dissertation, he can be called doctor. Now, Dr. Margaret T. Burroughs, the founder of the DuSable Museum here in Chicago, lived on the same block where my museum was created in 1990, April 1990. And I rang her doorbell one day, and she opened. She said, "Who is it?" I said, "Walter Williams." She said, "From here on out, you call yourself Professor Walter Williams." So I got all my credentials. Not from if I got it from a college, I wouldn't know what I know today. I'd be dumb. So I'm glad I didn't get it from them. I studied on my own and used my analytical mind to get this far. So that would be my answer to you, Brother Tyler.
So, okay, Dr. Williams. Now, let me ask you this. During the brief period of time that you were in school, did you ever hear any references to the Renaissance during that time period?
No, sir. Everything I know, I had to learn on my own. Well, I've been out here for 48 years, learning on my own. See, so
okay.
I went to the University of Walter Williams. That's the college.
Okay.
University I went to. Okay. Yeah. So that would be my answer, Brother Tarker.
All right. Let me open up Brother UL's phone line and I'm going to ask him the same question. Brother UL, are you still with us?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, during your time period in school, what was taught to you about the Renaissance from a school
perspective? Well, you
know
what, Tarker? I think we got some teachers of the Renaissance, but so little that that's been so long ago that I forgot whatever it is they taught me. Because during that time, I was kind of like, I got through school kind of half doing the work and cheating the other part of the work.
I think we all do some of that, man. So the way I look at it, man, what they was teaching us, it was totally away from anything that I need to know about. I mean, they told us that it was mandatory for us to learn Spanish. It was also mandatory for us to learn French. Nothing about our culture, nothing about our history, nothing, nothing, nothing. And then they had us, we got to learn fractions and decimals and algebra, and we need to know about Europe, Germany, all of these European subjects and European classes and stuff. But there was never anything for me to leave school and come home and identify with. Nothing. Man. And then they made it against the law and nobody done any shooting about it. Let me open up Dr. Williams' line again. Okay, Dr. Williams.
I got a question about that.
Okay.
Well, not about that. But anyway, I'd like to ask, how long, Professor Williams, how long you think people been on the planet?
I have no idea. Because I don't know nothing.
Okay.
I don't know how I got here on Earth. So therefore, if I don't know how I got here, how can I answer that question? Or any human answer that question? That question can't be answered.
Mm-hmm.
The mystery of life.
So you don't think they saw part of that by talking about this Lucy that's 500,000 years old?
No, man. Listen. Leaky theology. That they found some bones in Africa, the oldest bones in the world, and a female's bone, and they named her Leaky. Okay? And
mm-hmm.
when that happened, my wife told me, she said, I bet you they're going to come out finding the oldest bones in Europe, washing seawater. And that's a couple of years later, it come out with the oldest bones being found in Europe. Okay? So taking sticks somewhere. Okay? That's only a theology. So don't go for the Leaky.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what was that question?
Because, so you familiar with Pangaea, right?
Who?
The map, the story of the land used to be locked in this Pangaea, or some of them call it Gowana land or something like that. Pangaea.
All the land masses connected together.
Well, see, listen, man. Don't allow Europeans to teach you anything. Okay? They don't know nothing to teach you. Okay? They don't know anything to teach you. They'll take you off to La La Land. You'd be in La La Land thinking you in heaven somewhere. They'll tell you to take a child or so don't believe nothing that a European tell you until you investigate it yourself. And investigate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's my answer.
Well,
I've
done a lot of research into the Pangaea thing and the land masses, and I looked at it from a scientific standpoint, a historical standpoint, from scholars all over the world. A lot of the scholars have been banned. But the information is coming back out now because of they were banned because of the manifest destiny. The Europeans decided, look, we're going to lock this thing down. We're going to teach them away from their own identity, their culture and everything. We're going to whitewash it. We're going to change the paintings from black to white. We're going to infuse into their minds everything that we want them to know and keep them away from what they really need to know. So what I'm going to do right now before we go on, I'm going to take another little quick break, and we'll be right back because I got something else I want to look at right quick.
Welcome to Candid Africa, truthful and unapologetic.
Lock the doors because what I'm about to say is going to upset some people right next here. Okay. Christopher Columbus did not discover America. So anyway, there were actually many other mariners before Columbus that discovered America as well. Decades earlier, even eons earlier, there were so many people that were coming across these islands and this continent. But it's only been in the last century that evidence has surfaced and continually grown to indicate that many of these pre-Columbian explorers might have come from Africa. So the first scientist to promote this possibility was Leo Wiener. He started noticing things. There are lots of things that led him to encounter certain discoveries that made him consider that possibly if the origins of American civilization might actually be in Africa. So he observed so many linguistic and botanical and other similarities that between 1920 and 1922, he published an extensive three-volume piece called Africa and the Discovery of America. For example, he pointed out that Columbus himself was aware that African mariners had preceded him. In his diary of his second voyage, Columbus tells of how the natives of Hispaniola actually had given him gold-tipped metal spearheads that they said were brought by black-skinned people who had come in large boats from the south and southeast. Coincidence? I think not. No. So what's interesting about that, so upon returning to Spain, is that he actually took the spearheads and he sent them away and they had them assayed, and it turned out to be that they these spearheads were covered in this metal, that this alloy that the inhabitants called guanin, and the metallurgists actually found out that this was an alloy of 32 parts. It was like 18 of gold, 6 of silver, 8 of copper, which, dun-dun-dun, matched the metal used in spearheads made in Western Africa for thousands of years as carried by medieval African warriors, including the Mali and the Moors. The West Africans even called this metal guanine, the same name used by the natives of Hispaniola. But nothing more was said about that. Conspiracy. Well, probably because, you know, in the interest of Spain, it was in their best interest that they didn't want to have any challenges to the discovery and the claims of the islands of the West Indies. But, you know, Leo Wiener, being the curious person and the linguist that he was and the etymologist, he couldn't help noticing that the origin of these many place names and botanical names in Mesoamerica actually sounded distinctly like other languages in Africa, particularly Bantu and even Arabic. Wiener and numerous other botanists have also puzzled over the presence of certain plants that predated Columbus but originated in Africa. For example, the calabash bottle gourds. Now, this is a species originating from West Africa where they were well cultivated in America before Europeans arrived, now, even long before they existed in Indonesia or Polynesia. So, in fact, the Pacific was the last place that bottle gourds actually reached and expanded to. The Brazilian botanist George Margrave looked that the establishment of a particular variety of plantains in this region stands as a strong argument for ancient maritime contact between the Americas and Africa. That's bananas. B-A-B-A-N-A-S. So how do these plants and languages and other cultural elements get to the Americas? Well, you know, some believe... So what's that? Well, you're cheating. Well, you know, some people believe that... You know, over thousands of years, Africans migrated out of Africa and then over the Bering Strait, then down into South America, and things like that. Well, another explanation exists, and so get ready. There you go. Let it out of your system. Awesome. Africans had ships. In fact, they had four kinds of. They had unbelievable. They had a shipload of vessels and. They had away, the anchors away. So in fact, they had four kinds of vessels. And Nubian pottery. This is an example of Nubian pottery with a painting on it that shows a long-hold pottery art. That shows either a long-hold boat or a papyrus raft or a hauled-out canoe. And then this other painting beside it is from the first one was. From 3000 BC, and this is a bird's eye view of an oared riverboat in Chad. And it dates from 3500 BCE. Now, the Africans of Guinea also had dugout canoes hewn from these monumental trees on the coast there. In 1500, just a few years after Columbus's voyage, the Portuguese captain Pacheco Pereira wrote, "In this country can be found the largest canoes made of a single trunk. Some are so large that they hold 80 men. Now, the West Africans were known to lash two dugout canoes together, side by side, and no one questions the seaworthiness of a similar type of Polynesian catamarans. Well, here's a 15th century Portuguese painting of sailing canoes on the Congo estuary. The Portuguese, like Captain Pereira, had heard that African traders were visiting Brazil in the mid-1400s. Now, Islamic historian Amir Hajib reported that voyages west from Mali were happening in the year 1311, just 150 years before Columbus. Now, when he asked the Mali emperor, shown here, incidentally, holding a globe of the world made of solid gold, asked him, well, tell me about this rumor about Atlantic travel. And he said that his predecessor had commissioned an expedition with 200 ships filled with men and a similar number with gold and water and enough provisions for 2 years. And he said, go out and find something. And if you don't come back, so you find something or you run out of food. And unfortunately, only one ship returned, and the captains told the emperor that we sailed for a very long time until we met with what seemed like a river with a strong current flowing in the open sea. So, well, this story seems to describe the trade wind-driven equatorial current or the Canary Current. And you can see it's very easy for Africans from the south in the Angola regions to come up towards the equator and going westwards, or from the western coast of Africa north of the equator to go eastwards along that same current. Now, at least a dozen explorers, including Constantine Ravanes, reported seeing blacks upon reaching the New World. In fact, in 1513, Spanish explorer Vasco Nunez de Balboa, he said he met members of a tribe of Ethiopians in Panama. And according to Balboa's log, these men came from a totally black village that was 2 days' journey away, and he figured that these blacks had come from Ethiopia at a much earlier date. So there are also examples of physical evidence, including pre-Columbian African skeletons, which have been found throughout the Americas. Now, dating between 800 BCE and 300 CE, these murals are from the Temple of the Warriors at Chichen Itza. Now, they clearly feature, the color version is easier to see, but they clearly feature three races. And it's depicting black and Indian allies and a battle against white invaders. Now, because of their long blonde hair jewelry, a skin-hulled boat that we have here, right there, and also the fact that they're fighting naked, which was common for warriors from Ireland, they believe that these are Celtic warriors. And because this mural shows that blacks are clearly fighting on the side of the Mayans, that they must have been integrated into society much longer before this painting was done in order to form that form of alliance. Now, there are numerous pre-Columbian figurines with striking similarities to ancient African artwork, and they've been found in Central and South America. In southeastern Mexico, there are 18 rock statues that of heads up to 11 feet tall that are facing the ocean looking east. Now, archaeologists call them the Olmec colossal heads after the people that carved them, and they were produced for 50 to 200 years and date from at least 900 BCE when they were mysteriously buried for some reason. So it should, now think about it. It took enormous effort to quarry these. The smallest one was 6 tons, so 6 to 50 ton blocks, to quarry them and carry them 75 miles away from the quarry and then carve them and then erect them. These people that they modeled them after must have been important. Whoever they were, they must have been important to be remembered or obeyed or worshipped. Well, Jose Meglera Serrano, the archaeologist who first uncovered them, he pointed out that facial features look amazingly like African blacks, and they all display distinctive headgear or protective helmets. Now, however, some people think that these are actually the facial figures of overweight babies. Yeah, I think they needed to wear helmets when they were babies, if they think that. So, yeah. And then still others find it easier to believe that instead of Africans, those depicted are responsible for these sculptures, and as well as the Mesoamerican pyramids, were not African Americans, but dun dun dun. So why is it that so many people have never heard of this alternative of American discovery by the continent's nearest neighbors? So, I mean, look, now the thing, exactly, whoa, where'd all the continents go? So, this is, Look at how close this is. I mean, why people don't think that you could go this is closer compared to more than twice the distance that Columbus sailed. This will win a drink for you in a bar game sometime. Which state is closest to Africa? Maine. Yeah, look. See there, you got to need a globe for this. Look at that. You know, versus is it? So, yeah, geometry. Science. There you go. Yes. So anyway, so very few Americans know this. And why is it? So having examined textbooks throughout for years up until 2018, James W. Lowen says that although some books cite the alternative possibility that Vikings, Norse, or even Irish may have reached America first, not one textbook, old or new, mentions the West Africans. So whether or not you give any credence to this admittedly controversial Afrocentric theory, it's obvious that Columbus was not the first to discover America, but the last. So why did he make such an indelible mark on Western people's minds? Well, conquest may have a lot to do with it. Right, Eurocentrism. Unlike the mundanity of perhaps thousands of years of peaceful African transatlantic trade, the quest for gold and world domination makes a much better story. The story of Columbus remains the most widely accepted version of American discovery, most likely because it was the most recent, the most well-armed, the most documented, and the most similar in appearance to the authors of American textbooks. And one other thing that should be pointed out here is that in the years after Columbus discovered America, in 400 years, 20 million Africans were stripped from the coast of Africa, half of them dying in transit for slavery, who knows how many fleeing inland. And at the same time, within 5 years of Columbus's arrival in the New World, 90% of the indigenous population had died from disease or murder, 90%. So the fact is, that leaves few people to have a written or memory or an oral history of the seafaring of their African discoverers. Historian Samuel D. Marble wrote, "As a subject for research, the possibility of African discovery of America has never been a tempting one for American historians. We choose our own history, or more accurately, we select those vistas of history that more or less kind of explain to have the promise of the greatest satisfaction for ourselves, and we have had little appetite to explore the possibility that our founding father was a black man."
Did you like or hate what you heard? Let us know in the comments below.
Okay, everybody, we're back. Open up these phone lines, Brother UL and Dr. Walter Williams. The title of the broadcast tonight is "The African Who Set the Stage for the European Renaissance." Dr. Williams?
Yes.
Okay. Now, here goes my next question. Now, I've, like I said, stated earlier, I've did some research on the Earth being one landmass and scientifically and stuff. Because see, what we're doing now here, we have a team of people, and we're turning over every rock. We're doing investigations on not only on our scholars, but we're looking at a whole lot of other scholars that were saying the same thing that we said a long, long, long time ago, which were banned. They didn't look like us. They were Europeans. They said, "Well, you know, truth be told, such thing. Well, you can't say that. We're gonna have to outlaw you." So, just when it comes to Christopher Columbus or Christopher Columbus and stuff, what we looked at, we examined the diaries and stuff. It was actually written and stuff, and there's a lot of validity on what we found to match what was going on. But what is your take on what the gentleman was saying about Christopher Columbus and that kind of stuff there?
Well, that's the most horrible lecture I've heard in my life. As you listen to that,
okay, hold it. Let me write his name over here on the other side. Okay, so I got him. Go ahead.
Everything he's saying is maybe or perhaps or could be, and he's got our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, fighting with spears and stuff. Don't let nobody tell you about our ancestors fought. They had no armies or jails, and they practiced mayot. You can't practice mayot and go out and kill people and destroy us.
I agree.
See? So don't, that man don't know what the hell he's talking. You listen to that man, I was so bored listening to that foolishness that he's talking about. Yeah, he's all
well, that,
over the
that, well, that's just what I do on my show. That's how I run my show. And I was just asking the question, and you said the man was incorrect, and you point out his incorrectness. That's all you got to do, just straighten us out, man.
Well, see, I'm not, no, I know this is your show, but you asked me about what I thought about that man and his people.
No, I didn't ask you what you thought about the man. I asked you what you thought about what he said.
That's the same thing. The man has to open his mouth to say these things. So that's
okay, well, I don't look at it that way. But anyway, so you're saying that his information was incorrect. And so...
this information is in a whole lot of it. So I had to term what I heard and what he said coming out of his mouth as being foolishness. He don't know what the hell
okay.
he's talking about.
All right. There you go.
That's
real easy. Okay. That's a real easy answer to the question. Brother Yoel.
Yes, sir.
All right. What's your take on that information, man?
Well, I think that the timeline we're talking about, or going back to a time when, if you take a look at the world for what it is right now, and take a look at the possibility of what it may have been, maybe 50, 60, 100,000, or 500,000 years ago, maybe. You might, and there might be some kind of connection there and whatnot, you know. So when you look at the map and you look at how each country, South America, Central America, and North America, and to the left, and then you see Africa and Europe on the right, and... If you push those together like a puzzle, it's fun. It's very interesting, and it can't be necessarily dismissed totally how South America fits right into the armpit of Africa like that. So it says that if that was a time when that was connected like that, then that explains why there's 80 million of us in Brazil. Because we weren't just sitting on the African continent as we know it today, that maybe the world was connected, and that's why some of you they can't go anywhere they don't find us showing up at, because I'm sure that maybe Professor Williams might agree that the Egyptians didn't sit in Egypt, what we call Egypt today, and they didn't go nowhere. And they didn't have no ships to go anywhere. They didn't have no notion to go anywhere. I'm sure they had curiosity about other spreading out in other land and going somewhere and explorers and stuff like that at one time or another. So that's what I think.
Okay. Well, let me give you my take on it. And this is the way I see it, based on the personal research that we have done. We have looked at the geography, and you're absolutely correct, Brother Yoel. If you cut out the shape of the continents and you put them together, they fit together like a puzzle. And I've seen copies of the ancient maps that showed the exact same diagram. And here recently we've been dealing with works of the young man, gentleman by the name of Billy Cosman, that's shedding a whole lot of light on stuff that we have found through our own personal research. We know for a fact there's no such thing as a Negro. There never was. There's no such thing as an African-American. There never was. I'm not a black man. I never was. Not a Negro. I never was. I'm not colored. I never was. I didn't come here on a boat from somewhere. My family didn't either. We have always been here on this land. Now, when I look at the putting the maps together, we do see rivers in between some of the seams of when you put these continents. You got 75% of this stuff is a perfect match, but then there's a little small gap there. So it looks like a little river that ran through that. And we have dealt with the situation going back 25,000-30,000 years ago, and the so-called creation of Adam and Eve and all of that garbage. So it's not about that. We're talking about science now and gathering the facts and the information. So there's a whole lot of things that I know based on my own personal research, and but a lot of people that are not doing any current research, they are pretty much just stuck right there where they are. Nothing new can be introduced. They're not willing to entertain anything new. They're just stuck. So I have to go on what I know based on the research and stuff that we're doing, and call a spade, a lie is a lie. And if it matches and it goes together, then that's what I'm going to go with in my own mind and own beliefs. As far as the plugs and stuff I put together here this evening, a lot of information that I wanted to put there was simply unavailable, so I got what was in order to add it into what we're doing. And it's just a matter of us going these 3 hours and communicating. And all that. If somebody says something, they tell a lie. Well, okay. Well, that gentleman there, I disagree with that gentleman. I don't believe that. It's not such a thing. Okay, no problem. So that's the way I look at it on this broadcast. And as far as I know, the Earth being one landmass, I had to go along with that. Because there's no coincidence that these continents fit together that way. It can't be a coincidence, you know. And because I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at it from every conceivable angle under the sun, many, many different people talking about the same thing, all your ancient maps and stuff. We've done an investigation on that stuff. We have always been here. The problem is, people have bought into the slavery thing, and they are going on with, we all came from someplace else. Well, I have to disagree with it. Oh, we are Africa. I'm not an African. I did not come from that continent. My family members told me the same thing, and many other people say the same thing. So this is what I go with. This is my opinion of the situation. Now, a person could believe what they want to believe, that's totally left up to them. There's no argument. There's no debate. I know exactly who I am, and I know exactly where I am and where I've always been. So that's my take on the situation. That's how I look at it, based on our own personal research. And that it does include some books, but we have other means of gathering information outside of books and stuff, so we use that too. I'm gonna take a little quick break and we'll be right, everybody, we're back. We'll open up our phone lines. We're down to the last 17 minutes. The number to dial into the broadcast is 515-605-9757. Press 1 on your phone there to give me an indication that you got something to say, and we'll let you in. Our special guest is Dr. Walter Williams. Tonight's broadcast is the Africans who set the stage for the European Renaissance. I'm going to open up Brother UL and Brother Dr. Williams' line here. Dr. Williams, can you tell us about your books and how we can get a hold of those books, man?
I'm going to make a statement. You all said something about 50,000 years ago. You can't document any history 50,000 years ago. You know, we got to ask, where were these people living 50,000 years ago? What alphabet did they use to communicate with? What writing system did they have? And so forth and so on. So you can't go beyond 10,000 B.C., okay? So you can't document anything 50,000. So that's number one, okay? That's what I wanted to say about that. And I hold it there. I don't think, according to my research, I don't see where the world was all one landmass. I can't see that. So, but that's just me and my analysis during my studies. There's no base foundation historically to make that claim, but we won't go into that now. Now, so far as buying my books, The Historical Origin of Christianity and The Historical Origin of Islam, I'm suggesting that these people buy both of those books because there's a lot of information in those books. The Thesis of the Historical Origin of Christianity book has been out since 1993. So that's been out for, 33 years? And then... 30 years, one of the two. And the thesis of that book is saying that there's never been a man that will walk the earth in uniform in a race, creed, or color by the name of Jesus Christ. Never existed. And the thesis of the Historical Origin of Islam book, that's been out for 20 years. And the thesis of that is saying that there's never been a man that will walk the earth in uniform by the name of Prophet Muhammad of Islamic tradition. So those are my two books that I recommend that anybody can start their investigative research. Now, you got to remember now, where did civilization begin? It didn't begin in China. It didn't begin in India. It didn't begin in Europe. It began in Africa. That's where civilization began. The alphabet was created there by a people known as the ancient Egyptian African people. So... you have to think about that and understand that civilization started in Africa with the African people known as the ancient Egyptians. It didn't start no other place now, no other place. So if you claim that it started some other place, I would have to ask, what alphabet in these other places that you claim civilization started by whatever people? What alphabet did they use? See? So, anyway, you can buy my book by ordering through Brother Yoel from the African bookstore there. It's the African Underworld Bookstore in Chicago. And he can give you the information. And then you can also buy my book at your local African bookstore, where you ever you live, or you can go on Amazon to buy. It doesn't matter, because Yoel, he sells my book also, so you can take your choice to wherever you want to go. And then I want to leave my contact number. I don't have access to computer anymore. You can call me direct at area code 773-947-8255. 8662, area code 773-947-8662, and that's Walter Williams. Okay? About that, and I appreciate you having this program, have me on, and Joel on, and yourself on, every program that we do, we always try to bring new information to our African community. So I hope we achieve that point today by introducing the African by the name of Manuel Chrysostomus, who brought and started the Renaissance era for the Europeans. So thank you again, Brother Tahaka, for having me on, and I relinquish the microphone to Brother Yoel.
Okay, Brother Williams, thank you, Dr. Williams. And one more time, Dr. Williams has already stated in his broadcast that his new book, Dispelling the Myths of Ancient Egypt, will be out this summer, okay? Let me bring Brother UAM for closing statements that he might want to make. Okay, Brother UL, you got something else to say before you give us one more time about your books?
Okay. I'll say that as an old saying, everything is food for thought and grounds for further investigation. But they can get hold to me and all those other books that they want to get hold to, and you people who are listening, I'm asking them to give me a call and order, if not Professor Williams' book, some book, I don't care what book it is. If a bookstore like myself are to survive, we have to do more or do better at what we're doing and try to order some books from those stores so that we can ensure that they survive. Because from my perspective, people don't understand the war we're in right now. And part of that war is controlling the information, and they are already winning because they everything looks like right now that they are controlling the narrative, you know, and information is one of them. So you can contact me at Underground Bookstore in Chicago at 1727 East 87th Street. And the phone number is 773-768-8869, 773-768-8869, or you can email me at undergroundbookstore, the number one, at gmail.com or yahoo.com, whichever one you want to use as an email. So, but please, order something. If it ain't for you, for friends, get one of Professor Williams. If you got it, get it for somebody else. Share it with somebody else. Cousin, friend, distant friend, whatever. Any other books. Because right now, the crunch is on right now in this country, and we're struggling to try to maintain. Okay? That's what I like to say. So I look forward for my phone to be jumping off the hook for those people who listen today, that's on the broadcast, and those who will listen to it later. Thank you, Tahaka. Thank you, and thank Professor Williams for inviting me to come on with it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Brother Yoel. Gratitude. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we're bringing the broadcast down to the close. I certainly appreciate you all for being here. Hold on.
Tahaka here, y'all. Where were the judges, lawyers, prosecutors, police, et cetera, when she got pregnant with your child? They weren't in the bedroom or in the place where you two were. But now they're up in your business about child support and how much you have to pay and when, where, and why you have to see them about your child. Let's deal with it. Go to www.targetdeadelimination.org. They did me like that one time because I didn't know who I was. But it's a different day now. My contact information is at targetdeadelimination.org. Let's deal with the child support thing, man. Peace.
why has the history of African peoples been erased? Well, we don't live in a fair world. Things aren't fair. You don't get equal opportunities. You get the opportunities that you create for yourself. And if someone gets in there first and they conquer you, they colonize you, they enslave you, they simply make your history disappear to make it look like they conquered, colonized, and enslaved nobodies. When people have a history, that makes you a somebody. So if you remove the history, you become a nobody. And so your history disappearing, nobody's lamenting the loss of that history. That's why conquerors, colonizers, and enslavers make the people whose history they've conquered, colonized, and enslaved disappear. There are psychological reasons why people would want to associate themselves with a history. There is a link between what someone thinks of themselves, what someone thinks of their people, and their history. Now, scholars talk about personal esteem, that means self-esteem, and then you have interpersonal or group esteem, which is what you think of your group or what you think of your race, racial esteem. Self-esteem and racial esteem are not the same thing. Someone can have very high self-esteem where they think highly of themselves and very low racial esteem where they think very badly of other black people. And in truth, most black people have very high self-esteem and very low racial esteem. And that's one of the reasons why black people are prone to fight each other, prone to disagree with each other, prone to conflict with each other, because someone thinks very highly of themselves and someone thinks very lowly of their group. And what happens is, if people can call each other the N and the B words, they're really saying, I don't give a monkey's about the black race. They've really just said that their racial esteem is very, very low. But every black person usually has very high personal esteem. So if someone thinks highly of themselves and very lowly of their group, that is a recipe for fighting. That is a recipe for conflict. And the way to raise people's racial esteem is to introduce them to their history. And if the history happens to be a great history, a history that people objectively can be proud of, they will see their people in a very different way to how they see their people at present. And that's the difference between high self-esteem, low racial esteem, to having a balance where you have high self-esteem and high racial or ethnic esteem. The purpose of my work generally is to build that psychological balance between high personal esteem and high self-esteem.
Susan.
Everybody, it's me again, Tahaka. America is experiencing some tough times today, but there's a way out for you. All you have to do is get into the private, live out your days as a secured party and a creditor, instead of living as a debtor. I'll show you how. Visit TahakaDebtElimination.org. My contact information is there. It has to be tough struggling trying to make ends meet. But as a secure party and creditor, life's a little bit sweeter. All your bill collectors got you listed as a debtor. Let's turn this thing around to ArchidateElimination.org. Peace.